Meeting will come to order. We do have a quorum. We do not have minutes to approve. We'll hold them off until the next time. We're going to change the calendar around a little bit. We're going to start with Representative Johnson's House File 554. Representative Green, would you like to move Representative Johnson's bill?
Yes, I'd like to move Representative Johnson's bill to where is it headed?
Johnson.
General Register, to the General Register. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Green moves House File 554 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. To your bill, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, what this bill does is extends the expiration date by 4 years from 2012 to 2016 for the Mississippi River Parkway Commission. I'll just give you a brief summary of what the Parkway Commission is. The Minnesota-Mississippi River Parkway Commission is a bipartisan group of 15 appointed members. There's two members from the House and two members from the Senate. On the House side right now, it's myself and Representative Brandon Peterson, had been Representative Gregory Davids. On the Senate side, it's Senator Pappas and Senator Senjum. And there's also members from the Department of Transportation, DNR, and Agriculture Historical Society, Explore Minnesota Tourism, also five regionally appointed members. The task of the or mission of the Parkway Commission is to is two things. One is to promote and preserve and protect the Mississippi River Valley and its amenities, particularly as it relates to tourism, and thirdly, to develop the amenities and the values of Great River Road that follows along the Mississippi River. The budget for the Mississippi River Parkway Commission is found in the Legislative Coordinating Commission, of which we are a member, that passed up the House floor in the State Government Finance Bill and also on the Senate side as well. We're part of a 10-state, multi-state commission. The concept of the Great River Road and the Parkway Commission has been around since 1938, and we've been in state statute since 1963 here in Minnesota as a Parkway Commission, so that's how long we've been in existence. We meet quarterly as a group, the 15-member commission, and then we meet once a year or occasionally twice a year with the 10 states. Really, the point of the Parkway Commission is to provide a unified voice and vision and a point of communication for the Great River Road and for the communities along the river through the state of Minnesota. The Great River Road travels along 575 miles, 60 communities, 21 counties, and all 8 congressional districts. So again, we provide a an opportunity to bring all the issues, and particularly the issues as relates to tourism and commercial values of the Great River Road and the Mississippi River, so that can be a continuous experience for those traveling along the Great River Road and the Mississippi River. That, in essence, Madam Chair, is it. I would also add that the Great River Road has the distinction of being a National Scenic Byway, so that makes us eligible for federal funds for the state. And the Parkway Commission is the byway organization for the Great River Road. So we're able to be eligible for these federal grants. Over the last 10 years or so, we brought in about $4 million worth of grants for local communities to promote tourism and the like in our state of Minnesota along the Mississippi River. Thank you for the opportunity to testifying, and that, in essence, is the Parkway Commission. And again, we're looking for a four-year extension. This is the, I think, the second or third time we've done this over the last 10 years of the commission's existence.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any questions? Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, this isn't just a Twin Cities effort on this. This is the statewide, everything that's basically from Bemidji to Headwaters all the way down to the Gulf, am I understanding that correctly?
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct. You have it understood correctly. It's about the whole vision of the Mississippi River from Lake Itasca down to the Gulf. One of the things we're working on as an example of our working together among the states and among the communities is the Mississippi River Trail and the whole biking experience that we're trying to engender all the way down the river. So you are correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, my community is also a part of the Great River Road scenic preservation as well. A lot of my district is there since it's divided by the Mississippi River. So I am in support of your efforts on this because everything you've just said, I want to make sure we're statewide and we weren't looking at just a regional because I think we would have a better effort on a statewide. So thank you for your clarifications on that.
You're welcome, Madam Chair.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, I was just wondering about the fiscal impact. Is this being absorbed through the LLC, or how has it been done in the past?
Madam Chair, Representative Pepin, you have understood it correctly. It's a member of the Legislative Coordinating Commission, so that particular budget issue was in the state government finance bill that passed off the House floor.
Thank you. Any further questions or discussion? Any testifiers? I'll renew my motion that House File 554 be recommended to pass to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say no. So moved.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
I believe our next agenda item is Representative Holberg here to discuss House File 1205.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Committee. I've checked with Chair McNamara. He does not want to see this bill, so I think it needs to go to the General Register.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. I'll make the motion then. I move that House File 1205 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
Thank you.
And, Madam Chair, today I have with me a citizen from Lakeville, Mr. Jim Gutman, and he brought this idea to me and would like to speak to the bill.
That sounds fantastic. Please go ahead and please state your name and so on for the register.
Thank you. My name is Jim Gutman. I'm a Lakeville resident. I'm someone who enjoys the parks and trails of our state, and I take interest in the laws that govern them. I support this bill because it gives county governments more freedom to better manage their own park system revenues and expenses. By removing this restriction, it gives them the flexibility to set their own park system fee structure based on the going market rates for their area, for their region, and for the amenities and accommodations they provide. I think this is one way the hands of county government could be untied just a bit to let them do their best as they strive to provide viable county park systems in a challenging economic environment. So as a park visitor and advocate, I support this bill, and I respectfully urge you to support the bill as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any questions or other testifiers? Any discussion to the bill? Representative Simon, if you'll renew your motion that House File 1205.
Yes, I'll renew my motion that House File 1205 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. The motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you. I think now we're going to take a look at House File 1269, and Representative McFarland will be speaking with us.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce House File 1269 to be moved to be passed and moved to the General Register to the General Register. And with that, what we are doing here is we are removing from the definition for campaign finance under public officials, there were two sections added, and we would like to remove them. It's caused some difficulties, and it would be best for Gary Goldsmith from Campaign Finance to give you some history on this. And I do have an amendment, though. I'd like to offer the A11 amendment. if I could, Mr. Chair.
The A1 amendment is moved. Author's amendment.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, this amendment removes also the line 20, which is the supervisors of soil and water conservation district. And I will be having a testifier from them coming. So.
Is there any discussion on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the author's A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. A1 amendment is adopted. And to the bill, please state your name and who you're representing.
My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Mr. Chair, members, the board has jurisdiction over Chapter 10A, of which the definition of public officials is a part, and so this would affect the statutes that we administer. I'm not here to testify for or against the policy of having these people file economic interest statements with the board. I'm here to give you some background to explain the effect of the bill when it was enacted and what the effect would be if these two provisions are repealed. This came into existence in 2007, and it actually flew under the board's radar because it was an environmental and natural resources bill. House File 1930 was heard in environmental natural resources and also in local government metropolitan affairs, but it was never heard in a state government committee, so the board at that time wasn't tracking the bill and didn't recognize this language in it. It was never heard in any finance division or on the House floor. What actually happened was that it was then included in the House Environment and Natural Resources budget bill and not in the Senate version. In the conference committee it was included, and then it passed both bodies and became law. The effect of this law is to create two new categories of public officials, and those are the Watershed Management Organization and Watershed District Supervisors and also Soil and Water Conservation District Supervisors. I don't claim to understand exactly what these organizations do. I think there'll be testifiers or here that can explain that better to you. I can tell you that this was a surprise to the board when we learned that it was in the law, since we hadn't been tracking it. We hadn't done a fiscal note. We would have had we known about it. But in spite of that, we have made substantial progress in implementing systems to bring these people into the economic interest disclosure program. It actually added 65% to the number of people reporting to us. We had about 1,300, and this added about 850 more people, including three new classes. And these were people who weren't used to this system. They didn't know anything about it. Their organizations didn't know anything about it. And there weren't even good lists of who these people were or who the, there were lists of who the organizations were, but the lists of who the people were in some cases quite obsolete. But we've made good progress. I think we've got it about 75% implemented now, but there's still quite a bit of work to do. What this bill did, well, let me back up and talk just a bit about economic interest statements. There are two classes of officials that file economic interest statements under Chapter 10A, and I can't speak to who files under laws regulating other local officials, but under Chapter 10A we have public officials. Each of you is a public official. I am, my board members are, commissioners, assistant commissioners, and so on. These are people who typically have some sort of statewide or state government positions, and they file statements of economic interest with the board. There's another group covered by Chapter 10A, and that's local officials, but only those in metropolitan governmental units. So that is the seven-county metropolitan area and cities of more than 50,000 population. Those local officials are also required to file, but they file with their local governmental unit, not with the board. What this new law did was create new classes of public officials, so on the same level as you are and I am, which meant that they would file with the board. It's the only group of local officials that files with the board. And with respect to the outlying non-metropolitan officials, it's the only group of local officials that's covered by Chapter 10A at all. So as I said, it was both a challenge to the board and a challenge to the new officials who became officials as a matter of law. We did lose some public officials from these programs as a result. One watershed management organization, it's my understanding they all resigned, and that organization was disbanded. Others resigned, but not en masse, so that no other organizations were completely affected. And we've taken steps to let these people know what's going to be expected of them before they get on these boards. I think that gives you the background. The effect of having them under our law is, number one, they file economic interest statements with the board as opposed to with some other organization. That covers them by the gift prohibition as well, that you're all aware of. And finally, it includes them in the conflict of interest prohibitions that are included in Chapter 10A. So if there are any questions, I'll be happy to take them.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. Are there any questions from the members? Are there any additional testifiers?
Yes, there are.
Representative McFarland.
I'd like to call Sheila Bania, please. Ben. I also wanted to mention while Mr. Goldsmith has left, he came out to my local water management organization and met with the members about this issue. I will be having a testifier speak about that, too. So.
Thank you. Would you please state your name and who you represent for the record?
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Sheila Vanney, and I'm an assistant director with the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. And SWCDs are local units of government, political subdivisions of the state, which manage and direct natural resource management programs at the local level. They're organized along county boundaries, and each SWCD has an elected board of 5 supervisors. SWCDs do not establish or collect taxes as compared to other local or state officials. Their operating and program funds come from 3 primary sources: the state, mainly through the Board of Water and Soil Resources, their county, and other grants or fees for services. They're required to report to the Board of Water and Soil Resources and to the Office of the State Auditor on their financial information, and they receive periodic audits from these agencies. We feel that an unnecessary burden was placed on both SWCDs and the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board by designating SWCD supervisors as public officials and requiring them to file economic interest statements, and we would support the author's amendment to the bill.
Thank you. Are there any member questions? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question I have is, I think what we're trying to get at, obviously, in the statute is potential conflicts of interest. I think that's the key thing. And so I don't know enough to know what potential conflicts there could be. I mean, I'm thinking of one, I guess, would be if there were someone on a watershed district or a member of a watershed management organization that had ties to a developer, let's say, who wanted to develop in a watershed. I'm thinking of that. I guess I'm asking you to make a statement against interest in some ways, but what, if you could help us out here and talk about what would be some potential conflicts of interest, and maybe the answer is, practically speaking, there aren't any, but...
Ms. Vanney.
Mr. Chair, Representative, SWCDs do not have jurisdiction over those sorts of issues. Mainly what they're working with in approving allocations would be cost share for conservation practices with a private landowner, or easement programs. The Reinvest in Minnesota easement program is something that's administered through soil and water conservation districts. And so those kinds of programs get audits through the Board of Water and Soil Resources. I can't speak to whether there's any real potential for a conflict of interest in those situations. Obviously, some SWCD board members are farmers and landowners and do participate in conservation programs themselves, but they all go through the same ranking processes that any applicant for those programs would go through.
Thank you. Is there a follow-up, Representative Simon? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the follow-up question is, you know, we all do these economic interest statements. They take about, you know, 15 minutes every year or something mm-hmm. like that. They don't take very long. There's not a lot of disclosure. Is there a particular burden in doing them that falls more heavily on watershed districts or SWCDs?
Representative Winkler, I would say that, you know, when I was on the school board, I had to file a conflict of interest report, but it did not get filed with the state of Minnesota to be put on their website. It was filed with the district, and it was open to the public upon request, but it wouldn't be handled the same way as these are. And I think that when you're talking about, in some cases, city council members are serving on boards, same issue, the cities have those policies in place to have those conflict of interest statements on record.
Is there a follow-up, Representative Winkler?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative McFarland, so basically what you're saying is that there's some line between a local government unit and a state position, and with things like the Ballpark Authority, we're kind of maybe a little bit in between, and so we'll err on the side of it being a state issue, but for a soil and water conservation district or a watershed district, it's essentially local, and that should be governed by local rules. Is that kind of the policy foundation?
Representative
board?
McFarland?
That's true. Thank you, ma'am.
Are there any additional questions from the members?
And I have one more testifier who I think can really address this issue better, and that'd be Marty Long.
Please state your name and your association.
My name is Marty Long. I am a city council member for the city of North Oaks, and I was appointed to the Blamo Board, which is a watershed.
That's
as
Badness
a
Lake.
Board member. Yeah. Badness see? Lakes Area Water Management Organization. Yeah. This is the group that the Mississippi flows through our lakes and becomes St. Paul water. So it's somewhat of a premier watershed. We have had trouble keeping members on this. We've lost two who just refused to sign this because it really didn't apply. And again, it your statement of bringing it back to a local level might be more consistent versus being exposed. I appreciate what you people have to do, and I understand the reasoning for this. But a small watershed trying to get people, quality people, to step forward and volunteer, it's difficult already. And then to have these additional requirements, it's destructive to our volunteer force.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions from the members? Oh, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative McFarland. So did I hear you right that they are currently filing something with the local, or do they, would this relieve them so there'd be no conflict of interest statement filed at all?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I think it depends on who they've been appointed by or if they've been elected. Maybe our council could help on that.
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, could you?
I'll restate my question. I guess the quick question I asked was, by relieving them of having to file with the Campaign Finance Board, do they then not have any conflict of interest filing requirements at all? I mean, we mentioned that school boards and city, some other places have local ones that they have to do, but does it, would there, this totally relieve them of that so there'd be no conflict of interest so that if there was a question about decisions that people could look back and see?
Ms. Dyson, to that point.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I'm not sure about a filing. I'd have to get back to you on that, but I believe they'd be subject to conflict of interest laws that apply to local officials. There's a statute that applies to a local official, but it's an undefined term, but I believe it would apply to them. But I don't know about filing, so I can't answer your question on that.
Was there an additional follow-up on that? Any additional questions from the members? Are there any additional testifiers or members of the audience that wish to come forward and testify? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion to pass House File 1269 as amended and sent to the General Register.
Representative McFarland renews her motion that House File 1269 be recommended and passed as amended and sent on to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion passes. Our next file is House File 1411, Representative Kahn. Representative Hornstein, would you make a motion?
I would be very happy to move that House File 1411 be recommended to pass and sent, I believe, to the General Register.
Representative Hornstein has moved that House File 1411 be passed and moved to General Register. Are there any amendments, Representative Kahn?
Yes, I do have amendment. I have a DE1 amendment, which is in your file. Someone would move that.
Representative Hornstein, would you?
Yes, I'll move the DE1 amendment.
Is there any discussion? Representative Kahn, can you explain the amendment?
Sure. Well, the amendment is just kind of a rewriting of the bill in a more accurate manner. This is essentially a really technical correction. I have two people here. I have David Arbeit, who's head of the Geospatial Information Office, and I have Jim Rhodes from the Department of Administration. What we're trying to do is put all information handling into the geospatial, the MinGeo, what it's now called. And what this does is this just fixes up a complication in the appointment of their advisory council. Because you have to have agencies designated by the Department of Administration, and then each one has to designate their administration. And this bill just does it so that it works. The repealer in the bill, something that I'm actually a little embarrassed about, this is we required a review of the legacy language, which is a complicated new system going all through. The review came into us, was presented to the legislature last January 15th, and we didn't pay any attention to it. And it actually has lots of good recommendations for, it's just really technical cleanup in terms of saying where language should be. I have asked Mark Shepard to draft a bill based on the request I should have made a year ago to do this, and we'll see what happens. You know, we'll see if we get that in time to deal with at some point this session, or just deal with it sometime in the future.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. Is there any question or discussion on the amendment? Okay, the author's amendment has been moved by Representative Hornstein. The DE1 amendment, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. The amendment passes. On to the bill, Representative Kahn.
Well, my former colleague and expert on this, former Representative Jim Rhodes, suggested that this is a bill that could go on the consent calendar, which we haven't been doing at all this year. But I'll leave that to the discretion of the committee. If you want to do something new and exciting on the House floor.
Representative Kahn, did you have any testifiers?
No. They're here to answer questions, okay, if you have any questions about it.
Members, are there any questions? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kahn, just in looking at the makeup of the council, it indicates on the second page that they'll be part of the open advisory or open appointment process, which I think Secretary of State handles, if I'm not mistaken. Are we anticipating that the heads of the agencies could actually designate someone who went through that process that might not actually work in the agency but might have skill or interest in the area that the agency covers? You follow me?
Well,
Representative Kahn?
I'll bring Mr. Arbeit up.
Mr. Arbeit, please state your name and affiliation.
Yes, good morning. My name is David Arbeit. I'm the State Geospatial Information Officer, and I direct MinGeo. Mr. Chair and members, the provision, the advisory structure for our office is actually involves two advisory councils. one, which is called the Statewide Geospatial Advisory Council, and that's intended to represent interests statewide, not just state government, but all stakeholders. Those members would be appointed and have been appointed through the open appointments process. The other advisory council is effectively designed to focus on how the state is organized to coordinate state activities and is intentionally composed of state agency representatives. And so the original bill had that whole process also go through the open appointments process, and it ended up, you know, being really an unnecessary step, since the intent was to have commissioners assign people to serve on this council. So that's the technical amendment that, that you see here.
Mr. Albert, is one supersede the other authority-wise?
No, no, they're sort of have equal standing as advisory groups to my office.
Thank you. Did you have a follow-up?
Well, just Representative a comment, Beard? Representative, or Mr. Chairman, thank you for the explanation. A more careful reading, if I would have done that, line 1.26, the word both is in there, which would have indicated that there are two. And if you read carefully, one does say statewide and the other says state government. So thank you for calling that to my attention, clarifying. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Representative Kahn, was there any comment on it? Okay.
As I said, it's everyone's so unused to my having these simple, boring bills. You're all so suspicious.
We'll look forward to something more exciting next time, Representative Kahn. Are there any additional member questions? Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to come forward from the public to testify? And then you, Representative Kahn, you had no other testifiers that...
No. Just have people to answer questions.
Seeing no further discussion, would Representative Hornstein renew his motion to... to move House File 1411, be recommended and passed as amended and sent to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed signify by saying nay. Bill passes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Okay, next on the agenda we have House File 1036, Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I will make a motion that House File 1036 you recommend it to pass and go to state government finance.
All right, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 1036 is a bill to help us increase optimum efficiency. It's a bill that was excited to see earlier this week that falls in line with the governor's initiatives of trying to move government forward in a better direction. This bill also calls for consolidation of our vehicle fleet. What we do is, in trying to ensure optimum efficiency and economy, we ask that the commissioner reduce the state fleet by 15%. We exclude public safety vehicles. We've tried to be as permissive as possible throughout this bill because we do believe that the agency has been doing some work on this, and so we are trying to extend them some latitude. And also we've drawn out the deadline out to 2015 to try and help accommodate that as well. We've seen a lot of corporations moving in this direction. This is something that a lot of corporations have seen really help reduce costs and maximize efficiency. The city of Chicago has moved in this direction. The state of Georgia has just moved in this direction. And I believe that we need to keep up with the times and be as efficient and deliver the best return for our taxpayers' dollars as possible. And we believe that this is a great way to do so. With that, members, I'll yield to any questions that you may have.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Sanders. Have you spoken with the Commissioner Administration? I mean, is there a great number of excess vehicles floating around that aren't being used? Or, I mean, is there something that's been, you know, some glaring reason why we have to do this? I mean, I don't personally see a whole bunch of them sitting in parking lots not being driven. So I was, truly a matter of efficiency, or is it just something that arbitrary 15%? I mean, have we looked at this? Is that 15% the right number?
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, I've spoke with Jim Rhodes regarding this issue so far. We've had a conversation. Part of the issue and part of the problem is we can't get straight numbers on what agencies own what cars. We can't get an exact number on what exactly does the state own, what do we lease, what do we rent. So there doesn't seem to be a great number of folks that have great answers for that, and this is something that we've been talking about for a few years and looking at trying to do. This bill is different from past attempts, again, trying to provide more latitude to the commissioner as well as pushing out the date and time. But we have had some conversations and have had our dialogue left that we'll continue to work on agreement of language.
Follow-up question, Representative Nelson?
I guess I'm just a little confused that they've tried to get an inventory of the vehicles and that they own, and they can't get their hands around that. And so we're just going to do a straight cut without knowing whether it's the right number of vehicles to have. I see somebody coming, maybe that they have a better answer.
Someone from the administration. Welcome to the committee. If you could just please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Morse. I work for the Department of Administration in the Fleet and Surplus Services Division.
Welcome to the committee. Would you like to restate your question, Representative Nelson?
Well, just Madam Chair, and the question was: is this the right number of cuts? Do we have, you know, have we looked at? Do we have a great number of vehicles that are sitting unused that we need to make this cut? I mean, I'm all for efficiency and I'm all for not having a bunch of vehicles standing around, but I haven't seen that, so I guess I'm just wondering if this is the right number and have we done an analysis of where we're at and where the vehicles are.
Mr. Morris.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, no, I don't think that we know that 15% is the right or the wrong number. I think looking at the fleet as the bill talks about would help us come to the right number. We generally try to size the fleet by looking at utilization and seeing exactly as you're talking about, how are we utilizing the vehicles? Do we have vehicles that are underutilized, and how many do we have? But we need to study that a little bit before we come up with the right number.
Thank Representative you. Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder if the testifier could just address this notion that we don't know how many we have. I'm not sure exactly. Representative Sanders didn't say that exactly, but I, you know.
Mr. Morris.
Do we have stray cars?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as we look at the state fleet, there are four large sections of the fleet. There's a MnDOT section, there's a DNR section, there's a public safety section, and the rest of the fleet we look at as the combined agency section of the fleet. In the combined agency section of the fleet, which I am most involved with, we have agencies that own their own vehicles as well as agencies that lease from the Department of Administration. We never have had any agency with oversight of the whole fleet. So while we have a very good idea of how many vehicles we have, we at this point don't have an exact number that we can point to, but we do have a very close number that we can point to.
Madam Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Well, Representative Sanders, I think this is a pretty good bill. I mean, the 15% reduction is pretty straightforward. We're going to have 15% fewer workers. I guess having 15% fewer vehicles, there's some logic there. But the other good thing about the bill is that there's no savings booked here. It's, I think, just a good effort of reform and to do the work of following up and see where we go and see what money we save and move forward. So I think this is a good approach.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have, you say that, you know, we're not quite sure the number and things. Can you give us a ballpark? Are we closer to 10,000 vehicles in each of these areas or 30,000 vehicles that the state has? I'm kind of piggybacking off of Representative Winkler's comment of, well, we've got vehicles out there, but to help quantify for the committee what we're looking at.
Mr. Morris.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes. If we looked at vehicles and we defined vehicles as belonging to cabinet-level state agencies, first of all, not including MNSCU or the University of Minnesota, and if we looked at vehicles as licensed vehicles that operate on the highway, the number is close to 7,800. If we further narrowed it down and looked at vehicles as defined in this particular bill, which is passenger vehicle, light duty vehicles less than 1 ton capacity, the number would be closer to 2,500.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Has the department undertaken any efforts at this point to address the vehicle issue that's in question in Representative Sanders' bill?
Mr. Morris.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes. The Department of Administration has formed what we refer to as the Fleet Council, which has members from all of the agencies that have significant number of vehicles. The Fleet Council looks at the fleet as one entity and makes statewide decisions, including how to count vehicles and how to categorize them so that we have this information and can make management decisions.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the information that you have from your work, is that available? It's something you maybe provide as background for the committee so that we can get an idea of what activities you have undertaken to help with fleet management and things, just to, again, give us background on that?
Mr. Morris.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, we can provide information.
Okay. Thank you.
And then just to clarify on Representative O'Driscoll's question on the size of the fleet, this bill, Representative Sanders, does include MNSCU, correct? This would include looking at the fleet of MNSCU?
Madam Chair, as the bill is written now, yes, it would.
Okay, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sanders, I recently, earlier this year, went to a full-day workshop that there were members of, you know, MNSCU campuses, U of M, DNR, MPCA, Bowser, that also attended. Would your bill help to facilitate carpooling across divisions, because, you know, multiple divisions are involved with water and other activities, so that not only are you looking at the resources, but you're looking at more fully utilizing them efficiently and effectively? It, would this, by centralizing it, help facilitate that kind of savings and logical cooperation?
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Quam, I'll answer that this way. We are giving the commissioner latitude to do just that. That is our hope, that not only will we optimize cost savings, but we'll optimize efficiency. We, again, believe that the commissioner and those involved in this are experts in that, so we will leave that up to them. But, yes, that's the intent, is that they will do so.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I guess I really like lines 13 and 14, on page 2, lines 13 and 14 of the bill, where you're establishing emission standards with the goal of reducing fleet fuel expense. I think that's really a great goal. And I guess I was wondering if, in my interest in the state fleet has been in procurement of electric vehicles and plug-in vehicles, for example. And it was a bill that I authored with Representative Broad, I believe, back in 2005, where we said, when these vehicles become a little bit more available, which I think they are going to be now in the next couple of years, the state should make every effort to purchase them. Would this bill in any way hurt that effort? It seems like lines 13 and 14 would help that effort, but I would, you know, be interested in the author's comments and the witness's comments on how this might affect the state's ability to procure and promote electric vehicles and plug-in vehicles.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hornstein, I would say that, again, and even those lines are permissive for the commissioner to decide on. It's our intent that whatever the best value for the state is, whether it be electric, hybrid, whatever the vehicle needs, if it's a snowplow and it's diesel, whatever the best value for the state is, you know, that's my intent. So if it is an electric vehicle, then certainly, if it's the best value for the state, then I would hope that would be the commissioner and those making those decisions' intent is to follow through with that.
Thank you. I don't know if the department has any thoughts one way or the other.
Mr. Morris?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we are very much in line with moving away from petroleum dependence, and we consider it a priority to acquire vehicles that are not dependent on petroleum fuels, including electric vehicles. So we would continue to move in that direction.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Sanders. I really do like this bill. I think it has great intent, and I guess I'm just kind of looking for reassurance that the 15%, it feels a little arbitrary, and I'm always worried that here in St. Paul that we're kind of issuing edicts without really understanding some of the weird nuances that we aren't experiencing in our jobs or in our daily lives. Can you tell me a little bit more about the 15%? I do see that no savings are booked, so, but 15% does sound like a pretty hard and fast number, so can you warm me up to that?
Sure.
Representative Sanders, can you warm Representative Green up?
Representative Green, I would say in conversations with Mr. Rhodes as well, this 15% is a conversation starter. It's not a hard and fast number that it may be in the final bill if in our continuing discussion that is an appropriate number, then it may stay there. We may very well arrive at a different number in conversations between those that are involved. So it's merely a conversation starter to make sure that everyone knows that we are looking to move in a certain direction. But I would say that in order for that to be in the final bill, it'd have to be those involved would have to be somewhat warm to the idea.
Thank you.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Green kind of asked the question or expressed my concern too, that a bill that's concise and permissive and seems to embrace good management techniques has a rather blunt instrument on line 1.17 when it says you will reduce 15%. And thank you, first of all, as a transportation guy, for leaving the snowplows out of the deal. Still, if you're going to work on this, what other stop are we making? Is it going to the register? Or no, it's going to State Government Finance, isn't it? Okay, there is a chance to work on it. Okay, that helps me a little bit, but I just wanted to express my concern that 15% seemed to be an arbitrary number that I want to hear more about. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess we're kind of all thinking around the same line here, because as I look at that, I'd be a lot more comfortable if instead of saying a must reduce by 15%, language that would say make that a goal of 15% reduction. That way it would give the flexibility if we can only get to 14.5%, and if we get that extra half a percent means cutting necessary vehicles out, and we could go beyond that also, but that would give a little more flexibility, I think, if we set that as a goal instead of the way it's written. It has to be by 15%, and I can see situations where that could be a problem. And I only wonder if the author of the bill would be willing to entertain that as a suggestion.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, I guess I would ask you if you wouldn't mind if we could have discussions offline before the next stop and work together and discuss that with the commissioner and those involved and see what is appropriate. If you're willing to wait, certainly willing to have that conversation. I guess at this point in time, I'd rather. The intent is I want to see where are we going to end up as far as the number goes. Is 15% too high? Is it too low? We are looking at that. So I guess I would still not even being 15% not being a hard number, I guess I would still like to wait just to even say if that is an appropriate goal, even at this point in time. If you're willing to wait until we get to state government finance and to work in between, I'm certainly amenable to that.
Senator Nelson.
We'll work offline, but I'm not on state government finance, but I would be a lot more comfortable if that set a goal instead of just the way it's written. It's a hard and fast number. We've done that a lot of other bills where we're trying to move our state in a different direction, and we've set a goal that hopefully we achieve, but that's our goal to meet that, but it gives us a little more wiggle room in case for unforeseen reasons, and between now and 2015, for some reason, we can't meet that hard 15%.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the testifier, is it Morris or Morse?
Morse.
Morse. Okay. Mr. Morse, a question for you that comes from something I got from a constituent. She works for a state agency that I won't name, but it would be in that other category, not one of the big three that you mentioned. And she commented to me that she thought it was strange they had a vehicle for use for workers who needed to travel. And one day she said they got an order that they were getting a new vehicle. And she and her coworkers wondered why. The one that they had was perfectly good, but she was told that regulations of some kind said that the vehicle needed to be replaced, even though in her judgment, at least, the vehicle was perfectly fine. And that concerned me. And I'm wondering if you can speak to, and maybe it's too hard to generalize because there's so many different types of vehicles, what is the protocol for when a vehicle is supposed to be replaced for either safety reasons or other reasons? Because at least in this one case, I know it's only one anecdote, my constituent was alarmed that they needed to replace their vehicle when she didn't. She thought it was perfectly fine.
Mr. Morris.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, we provide vehicles to a lot of different agencies. Agencies own their own vehicles as well. The vehicles that we provide, when we send a vehicle out to an agency, when we order it and receive it new, we plan a life cycle and it's a planned replacement of that vehicle. And we let the agency know what the cost is going to be, both in monthly cost and in per mile cost. For vehicles like automobiles, the life cycle might be from 2 years up to 7 years, and from a low of 70,000 miles to a high of probably 120,000 miles. We work with the agencies then over the course of the life of that vehicle to make sure that it's meeting their needs and that it is meeting them cost effectively. We're very proud that our cost per mile average is lower than the reimbursement rate. We provide vehicles at an average of about 46 cents a mile. The reimbursement rate is about 51. The AAA is talking about 58 cents a mile as the average nationally. If we have a low utilization or a vehicle that reaches the end of its life, we talk with the agency about, is there another way to meet that transportation need, a more cost-effective way? I'm going to assume, although I don't know the specifics, I'm going to assume that this vehicle had reached the end of its life in years, probably getting to the point where replacement parts are not as easy to come by, and keeping it longer from a fleet management perspective probably puts that operation in more danger of breakdowns and disruptions to their business practice. I know we keep our personal vehicles sometimes for a very long time, but when you're in a business environment and you're moving these in and out, we want to be sure that we're providing reliable transportation to the agencies that lease from us.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Mr. Morris, that helps. Thanks. I'm wondering then, either for you or for Representative Sanders, I'm wondering whether this bill, and I think it's carefully crafted and I like it, I'm wondering whether line 2.10 would cover that. When it says vehicle acquisition, use, maintenance, it seems to me it would, but I'm far from an expert in this area. So would that cover what I just mentioned, this idea of when do you retire a vehicle?
Mr. Morris?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, when we talk about acquisition and disposal, we talk about both years and miles, and we work very closely with the agencies to come up with the right number that works for all of us.
Thanks.
Any more questions? Oh, Mr. Morris?
Madam Chair, I would like to say that I would like to recognize that while we have looked at the four sections of the fleet, our goal is to bring fleet management in the state up to the best fleet management level possible, and there are some agencies in state government that do a very good job of fleet management. MnDOT, DNR, and public safety are three big examples of where fleet management happens on a very organized and well-ordered manner. Our intent is to bring everyone in state government up to the level that these agencies are operating. Our intent would not be to impose any regulations or rules on those agencies that would hinder them, but to bring everyone up to their level of good fleet management in the state.
Senator O'Driscoll?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just what you were talking about is the request that I had about what you're doing right now, and perhaps you can get that to the committee administrator who can disseminate it committee at large, because it does sound like everyone has the similar kinds of questions. So I think we eagerly await that information.
Okay, is there anyone else that would like to testify for or against this bill? Welcome to the committee. If you could just identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Lund. I'm the state maintenance engineer for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. I'm responsible for the corporate level oversight of the Minnesota DOT fleet. I'm here on behalf of MnDOT to speak to House File 1036. MnDOT owns and operates approximately 4,000 vehicles of various sizes and functions. Everything from snow fighting equipment to roadside maintenance equipment to exploratory vehicles such as drill rigs. Of that 4,000, approximately 1,500 are being considered under this bill. That's the light duty fleet. So that was a pretty solid number, but an approximate 1,500. Light duty vehicles are used across all areas of the department, from maintenance services to delivery of our construction program. The average utilization in MnDOT for vehicles affected by this bill is approximately 13,000 miles per year. MnDOT has a progressive fleet management operation, and I was going to say, as I believe would be echoed by the department administration, but I'll thank Tim Morris for actually acknowledging that ahead of time. MnDOT's fleet management is led by a certified automotive fleet manager, and he works for me. In each of our districts, we also have a designated fleet manager in each of the 8 MnDOT districts. We are committed to performance measures in the fleet management area, and we are active in fleet management technologies such as M5, the tracking system for fleet, performance measured, skilled fleet repair, and new technologies as well. MnDOT prides itself on its bread and butter operations such as snow and ice services and delivery of a significant construction program. One backbone to this is the necessary fleet to get the work done. While I would acknowledge we have vehicles on both ends of that spectrum, underutilized and overutilized, I believe we are about the right location with our average light duty utilization of 13,000 miles per year. I am not here to say that MnDOT could not function under the procedures as described in this bill, but I do have concerns of the added oversight and added process that could result if an agency such as ours, one that significantly and actively monitors its fleet, is required to administer its fleet through a third party. Another concern, of course, is the across-the-board cut of 15%. This would result in a cut of approximately 230 vehicles, and that would translate to about 3 million miles of work travel that would either have to be done in a different way or not done at all. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious that 13,000 miles, if indeed, as was stated earlier, that the the retirement of the fleet is normally between 70 and 120,000, 13,000 miles would mean in 6 years that you're running about 78,000 on the vehicle. I'm just wondering if maybe that 13,000 limit might not be moved to 15,000, 16,000, and still be within the parameters of what one would consider the normal lifespan of the vehicle.
Madam Chair, Representative, I would acknowledge that to actively and responsibly manage your fleet, you have to actually include cost into that equation, looking at cost of actual keeping that vehicle in service. And we have some vehicles that can go beyond the targeted life cycle for actually use. So that would happen on a continuous basis where we would have to actually monitor the fleet to know if we're getting the best return on the cost. Because we do, in-house, we have highly skilled mechanics that focus on the heavy-duty fleet. However, there are times when they do service our light-duty fleet as well, but we do actively outsource our light-duty repair as well to try and optimize when to conduct those services. I'm not sure. I hope I answered your question. I'm not sure I exactly did.
Yeah, being a little bit one of the older members on the thing, I used to remember that when 100,000 miles was a sign of tremendous achievement, that you could drive a car that would last 100,000 miles. Today, one buys a used car that has 150 and it's considered low mileage. So I'm wondering if indeed, you know, we don't need to look at the fact that maybe the six-year lifespan could not be extended and still have a very functioning fleet. That's all.
I would agree, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair and Representative, I would agree. That has to be acknowledged.
Okay, additional questions? O'Driscoll. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is probably a question to Representative Sanders to the testimony that was provided by the department. In here, you've said that you've exempted public safety or for public safety purposes. I'm assuming that some of the vehicles that MnDOT would operate, if they're snowplows, highway helpers, some of those kinds of things would fall into that category. Am I correct in that assumption?
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, that is correct. They are exempted from this bill.
Representative O'Driscoll, follow up.
So that may help with some of the concerns that you have with the 250 vehicle reduction in your fleet.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would acknowledge that since this bill only addresses light duty, the rest of our fleet would be exempt. This is only on light duty fleet.
Okay. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much. So I have one final question, and I think Mr. Lund is probably the person best able to answer it. While I think some of the energy goals are laudable, I do have a big concern about line 23 and 24, this issue of privatizing maintenance of the fleet. And I'm wondering what kind of impact would that have, Mr. Lund? Because my sense is that you're probably doing a pretty good job and being efficient, and would the privatization actually add costs? Do you have a sense of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
You hinted at that, and I wanted to.
I need to say that our mechanics in our fleet area are probably the most highly monitored through the data that we calculate for punching in and punching out. And then I have to say that although this is this bill addresses light-duty fleet, our heavy-duty fleet remains unaffected by this bill. Our mechanics that we maintain are primarily there to deliver on our heavy-duty fleet. We would use them for some light-duty repairs to level out workload. However, we do use outsourcing already for our light-duty fleet. So, again, I don't think it would have significant, which is a relative term, impacts to our light-duty fleet. We use outsourcing already for our light-duty. The key is to keep our skilled mechanics for our heavy-duty snow plows, and they need to be there when we need to get a plow back on the road.
So, one final point. So, but since they are doing some of this work anyway on the light trucks, outsourcing that or privatizing it could potentially add costs as a result of this. Is that
it would affect the way Madam Chair and Representative, it would affect it. We use it to workload level. We do provide in-house maintenance when the times are right. I'm not sure if we would be forced to reduce mechanics because of that. It's not clear. 230 vehicles isn't a huge amount, but We already have those facilities in-house. We would have to, I guess, live with the ramifications and not know right now.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Hornstein.
I think there might be an unintended consequence just from lines 23 and 24, potentially adding cost and actually making the operations less efficient. So just a concern to raise about that.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Hornstein and the testifier that had stated this in his testimony as well, this is permissive language. Line 1.23 says consolidation or privatizing, and that's up to the commissioner. The intent of this bill is optimum efficiency, so that's permissive language. If you flip to page 2, line 2.15, the commissioner may delegate to another agency the authority. So it's very permissive language. It's only if it is deemed that that is the most efficient, most cost-effective way to do business. So if it's not, then the intent of this bill is to not privatize. But if there are some savings or efficiencies where that can happen, one example is the mosquito control, where they have privatized some of that, then that is the goal to look at. And there are many options that will need to be discussed, but it is permissive language.
Thank you. Do you have any, I think we're kind of getting ready to close here. Do you have any final words, Representative Sanders? Oh, did you have another question, Representative Nelson?
Yes, Madam Chair. And maybe I'm reading this wrong, but on line 1.20 it says the commissioner must, and then on 121 and 123, and 123 says establish a process for consolidating or privatizing. I guess I don't read that as permissive. I think that I read that as a mandate. They must do it.
Representative Sanders? Sorry.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Nelson, yes, they must consolidate or privatize. So if the optimum efficiency is for the department to consolidate and they can establish the process, which later in 1.24 and so on, that process is permissive and laid out and things that we'd like to see. If the department or the agency is better at doing that than it would be privatizing, then that's where it should stay, and that's who should make those decisions. If it's determined that privatizing the fleet or the process is more efficient and more effective, then that's obviously what we would like to see. But it's permissive as to the commissioner gets to make the choice as to which one is more efficient or more effective. So they need to make a choice, but we're not saying that they must privatize by any stretch. We want the optimum efficiency choice to be chosen.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But what happens if, during the process of looking at this, they determine that consolidation or privatization is not the most efficient and cost-efficient for the state to do, and that maybe the current practices that they're doing, and it sounds like they're doing a good job of that, are the most cost-efficient. What happens then? Because this is saying they must do one or the other. I see Mr. Morris is back.
Mr. Morris?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Also in the bill is the ability for the commissioner to delegate authority to an agency who has a fleet program in place. As we look at MnDOT, we think that they have a very good fleet program in place, and it would be our intent not to minimize or to hold MnDOT back from achieving even more than they are now. It would be to work with MnDOT, delegating them authority to continue their excellent program.
And Madam Chair?
Representative Sanders.
Consolidation doesn't just mean eliminating vehicles from the fleet, but as you've heard, we have many different silos of vehicles. We have many different agencies that have vehicles. It's also talking about consolidating the process, and that's what 1.23 is talking about, a process. So it's not necessarily just talking about a hard number of fleet vehicles, but we're talking about the process here, which I think every testifier that's been up to the table has admitted that we, although doing a good job, we can do better, and there are areas that need to be looked at.
Okay, looks like we're about done with the discussion here. Would you like to renew your motion, Representative Sanders?
Yes, Madam Chair. I will renew my motion that House File 1036 be recommended to pass and be sent to State Government Finance.
All those in favor of the Sanders motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion does prevail.
Thank you, members.
Thank you. We'll move on to the last bill, House File 1376, Representative Leidiger. And while he's making his way up here, I just wanted to make the committee aware that we have break next week, as you all know, and then the following week is the policy deadline. I'm trying to get through a bunch more bills, and so look for an email. We were going to try to meet for a time on sometime Monday before. I think we have to be done by 3, but sometime in there. So if you could, we're trying to work out a room schedule. If you could just be sure to check your email messages and keep in the back of your mind, we might have a Monday meeting. Okay. Representative Leidiger, would you like someone to move your bill?
Someone would, please, to the government finance.
Representative O'Driscoll.
I move that House File 1376 be approved and moved to government finance.
Okay, to your bill.
Thank
Senator
you.
Leidiger.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I have one amendment, and I hear that I may have an additional oral amendment. I'd like to first just give the overview, then bring in the amendment because it's an exception to this, and then we can talk to that exception,
okay,
and then move from there. E-Verify. The E-Verify system is a federal government system that allows employers to electronically verify the Social Security work status of new employees. It's done through the I-9 verification process, which the federal government has put online, so that verification can be done, in theory, more rapidly and more accurately. The intent is to prevent persons without legal work status, that's illegal aliens, aliens without proper working visas, etc., from being hired. In 2009, the legislative auditor's report said that Minnesota is situated somewhere in the middle of E-Verify use. So that's two-year-old information. Employers who use E-Verify surveyed by OLA generally have favored using it. It solves two problems for them. One is the possibility of having their businesses fined or even shut down by the federal government if they're found to employ illegal workers. And then the other is facing discrimination complaints if they try to follow up on workers whose information kickbacks from SSA is incorrect. The system has a built-in way of handling those issues, and the employer only has to follow the process. Some employers have complained that using the system costs additional resources in terms of training and data entry employee time. 88% of the 73 state vendors surveyed said that there was little or no increase. 11% said a moderate increase, and 1% said that a significant increase. E-Verify has become more accurate over time. There is an issue of accuracy, and we're going to hear about that. OLA said that nationally 93% of queries result in immediate verification, but it still isn't a foolproof way of to check IDs, since illegal workers can still purchase, steal, or otherwise acquire actual identities that then become part of the database as if they were legitimate. Now, this the bill, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, it did pass the House, did not pass the Senate, and Governor Pawlenty then issued an executive order in 2008 mandating the use of E-Verify by state government agencies for vendors and contractors with state contracts in excess of $50,000. And just recently, Governor Dayton has let the executive order on E-Verify lapse. I'd like to introduce the First Amendment, which you should have. I don't have a copy. And what it does is it exempts one agency, and that's the State Board of Investments, mainly because the vendors that they work with have far more inclusive criteria in terms of verifying those people. They're dealing with people that are verified by the SEC, essentially. And I have State Board of Investment here if we'd like to hear from them.
At this time, Representative Leidiger, they can come up if they so choose. Representative O'Driscoll, would you like to move the A1?
Madam Chair, I'll move the A1 amendment to House File 1376.
Amendment has been moved. Did someone want to? Would members like to hear?
Any discussion?
No discussion.
Okay.
Any questions? Okay. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment does prevail. And at this time, would you like to? Do you need to wrap up, or did you want to?
Yes, I'd like to just further discussion and then wrap up.
Okay.
The currently in a company, and I am a company owner. I have worked with I-9s for many years. Currently, when we verify, and we all went through it, we all had to sign an I-9. We had to provide information, proof of who we are, and companies file that away, and that's it. It's just put on file. Many times. Illegal aliens or anyone can certainly get counterfeit documents, show it to a company, and the company would never know otherwise that they're dealing with someone who's illegal. At least we have a system, and it's created by the federal government, to go ahead and check those Social Security numbers, the E-Verify website. It gets into databases from Homeland Security, gets to the Social Security Administration. So we have the makings of a good system to check out our people. And what that does, of course, is it limits the liability for companies that are out there. So with that, I'm going to wrap it up and just stand for questions.
Okay. I think maybe would anybody like to address the bill that's in the audience today? If anybody had any questions for Representative Leidiger, I know the chamber wanted to talk. But
yes, I forgot. This is the chamber's Cecilia Reddell from the Minnesota Chamber, and she has some comments about the bill.
Thank you. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Cecilia Rattel from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I'm also speaking on behalf of an immigration coalition that we are a part of that includes Minnesota Agri-Growth Council, the Minnesota Milk Producers, Nursery and Landscape, and Hospitality Minnesota. Our major concern with E-Verify at this point is the error rate. And as long as the error rate remains high, mandatory E-Verify puts employers in the position of potentially hiring people who are not legal to work or not hiring someone who is legal to work. Either way, there's a liability for employers. And so we would urge the committee to only implement this section of the law and make it effective once the E-Verify system has been deemed accurate. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Rattel. I really appreciate the Chamber's position on this, and thank you for coming to testify. Do you think that if we were to enact this legislation would have any kind of negative impact on the overall job situation in the state? And I think you mentioned a lot of diversity of employers, the Agri-Growth Council, the nursery and landscape industry, the hospitality industry. Do you have any concerns about that?
Ms. Rattel?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hornstein. Our position on this is if the E-Verify system was accurate and reliable, that would help employers do things quicker. However, if it is inaccurate and not reliable, it's burdensome for employers and results in people having to, you know, take time off, or an employer having to say, you know, don't come to work until we figure out the kind of whether this is a false negative or the details of it. So until the system has been, you know, modified and ensured accuracy at the federal level, really, because it is a federal program, we would have concerns about it.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, how is this different than the current system with Social Security, where employers get no match letters back after they've paid Social Security on their employees, and they're told that this Social Security number doesn't match this person's name. How is this better or worse than that? Or are you not aware of that?
Ms. Rattell?
Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, the latter. I'm not aware of that. That's not something I've worked on. I'd be happy to talk with you about that issue.
Okay, Madam Chair. The thing is, like I said, right now the Social Security Department is doing this with employers, and we've heard about that around the state where different employers have had laid off a whole bunch of people because they get these letters back, and sometimes it's a simple matter of someone filling out a form or typing it in, flips a number around or types a wrong number in, they come back and verify, no, this is my Social Security number, but they get a letter back from Social Security saying this person is not does not have a valid Social Security number, and they're told they have to get rid of this employee or lay them off or verify that they have the numbers right. That's currently going on, and so I know if this is a step above that, if it's a more of a burden on our employers if these aren't accurate. I know my younger brother, right after 9/11, and when they came out with some of the airport screening things, his name was one of the ones that was on a terrorist watch list because David Nelson, and that's my brother's name, was on, that name was one, and there was a big write-up in the paper about that Dave Nelson from Ozzy and Harriet fame also had this problem of not being able to fly. They've since solved that problem, but you know, we need to make sure that if we're going to use a system that it's accurate and that people aren't being, as the testifier said, either being hired that are not documented to work here or not being hired when they are perfectly legally able to work here. So, I mean, I have some concerns about this.
Okay. Representative Green?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I too share those concerns, and I have an amendment, an oral amendment, that I think Mark Shepard has the language for. It would take, if we go to line 1.11, the effective date, it would essentially strike the sentence that's there and replace that with, this section is effective when the commissioner of MMB determines the e-verify system produces accurate results.
Mr. Shepard, would you like to report the amendment?
Madam Chair, members, I do have that written down as Representative Green indicated, and I will give it to Mr. Hamilton. It, as Representative Green indicated, it would just delete lines 11 and 12 and insert the language that she read. This section is effective when the Commissioner of Management and Budget determines that the e-verify system produces accurate results.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, how would they find out? I mean, and how and when would they find out it's more accurate? Just curious.
Maybe we'll turn that over to Ms. Rattell.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative McFarland. This is something that, because it's a federal system, would have to be done at the federal level. And a few years ago, there was a study that was done. For example, in the report, the Social Security Administration discovered that approximately 17.8 million records contain discrepancies that may result in incorrect e-verifying. So it's just a matter of getting the system into place that works, and that's something that would have to be done at the federal level, and then the state, the commissioner, would be able to, you know, report back and say it is now accurate.
Madam Chair,
Representative McFarland.
I guess my point is, how often do they do this report? I mean, could we be waiting 5 years to find out, or next year, or what?
Ms. Rattell.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative McFarland. Yes, I mean, it is something that we have been urging the Minnesota congressional delegation to push on, you know, developing a more comprehensive immigration system, and this is a part of that pillar. Because until this is, you know, accurate and reliable, it's really difficult to do the enforcement or the other sections of the immigration policy that need to take place. So it would be one way of Minnesota encouraging, you know, the federal government to have some action as a comprehensive immigration reform.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if this is either to Representative Green or Ms. Rattell. I guess I'm kind of looking for a definition of accurate if we're going to put this into the in the language here, and I guess kind of what the definition of reliable is.
Madam Chair.
Representative Leidiger.
May I take a two-minute recess?
Yes, we will. We will take a quick recess.
All right, thank you.
And I'll finish my question later.
All right. Madam Chair, I should instruct Representative Leidiger that he could have asked Representative Winkler to keep talking until he gets back. I did that.
Most effectively, I believe.
Remember, I'm always available to fill in.
There you go. He said 2 minutes.
What? The humorous anecdote? No, I would have gone on with books and so on. There you go. Hey, today's the Sesquicentennial is the first in this game. For the next 4 years, we're going to have the Sesquicentennial of something every day. That will be true. Actually, every day we have the Sesquicentennial. This is true.
Always just take pretty details, Representative.
It's all we can do in the minority.
I just think that... Chair beer today. I pass out sunglasses with that pretty tie.
Somebody reminded me it was out today, and I forgot to put that on my calendar. You're certainly making a statement. What happens to my wife leaves before I leave? I get out of the house without an adult checking my work.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Proceed. I think we're in the middle of a question. You're able to. Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I got to call the meeting back to order. Representative Sanders, you were in the middle of a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I guess I'd like a little clarification on what accurate and reliable means. It seems fairly. I guess it could be fairly subjective, and I just want to make sure that, are we talking about this needs to be 100% accurate and reliable to be used? Is it 94%? I guess I'm not sure where it is right now, and I guess I'm kind of looking to see what are we trying to get to with this language to say that it's accurate and reliable.
Ms. Rattel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Sanders. Our position isn't a very specific number, but what it is that it is accurate. And there was one report in the legislative auditor's report, and I believe this was 2007 or 8, it found that for foreign-born citizens, it was about 10% erroneous, So for some of our, you know, agricultural workers, that's a huge number for them. And to have to take time off during the summer, you know, maybe when they're doing the crops or that sort of thing, it can have a huge impact. So it's not so much finding down and nailing down, you know, saying 100%, but making sure that this isn't a regular, you know, inaccurate system and ensuring that it's accurate. So it's one of those things that, you know, we don't want to have a piece, 50 different, you know, laws about how accurate it has to be. What it needs to be is done at the federal level to ensure accuracy and have a system in place. Because one of the things that I didn't know, you know, that I don't think is as well known, that I actually heard, I think, somebody talking about maybe during the short recess, is that the only thing that the system does is require a Social Security number. So the same Social Security number can be inserted for multiple people, and it says yes or no for that same Social Security number. It doesn't actually ensure that that's the person using the Social Security number or that it doesn't already have another name tied to that same number. So there's a lot of things about the system itself that need to be more made more accurate.
Well, actually, I'd like to hear from Representative Leiter of his opinion of this amendment, and then Representative Quam, you're next on the list after that.
Well, Madam Chair, I actually support that amendment as it is written, especially based on the changing of the opinion and how it's emerged from the chamber. Now, this has been a program; it's been in the works. We've used it, but it is time to. But it has been reviewed by the chamber, and it is time that we really encourage the federal government to make the system far more accurate. So, but we want to keep the language in the omnibus bill because it's something that I think all of us understand. There's a need for this. As our population increases over time, we do need to verify the people that are working. But I do support the amendment.
Okay. Representative Quam?
Madam Chair, it was brought up that we've actually had this for several years under executive order, and I didn't see the sky fall, the waters of Minnesota dry up. And I'd like to, you know, we're talking about accuracy, and apparently these are national things. In the state of Minnesota, last year and the year before, and the years that this has been active, how many workers have been unjustly denied work because of this system? And then how many total workers have gone through the E-Verify, both in the, you know, because of the governor's executive order and in total for the state? Let's have some Minnesota data here.
Mr. Tell?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Quam. There's not a specific number that's been collected because the system actually doesn't collect that. But one kind of, I don't want to say anecdotal because it is cited in multiple places. I'm happy to provide this for you. But, for example, requiring E-Verify in Minnesota would cut right at the heart of Minnesota's agricultural industry. Because Minnesota ranks 7th currently in the country for the number of farms within the state at 80,992. And according to the U.S. Census, Minnesota employs about 50,000 people on those farms. And if E-Verify were mandated, a conservative estimate is that 400 authorized workers in the agricultural industry alone could be told they're not eligible to work.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, again, this was an effect. So apparently, since you don't have any hard data, this sky is falling, Chicken Little thing did not occur over the years that this has been in effect because you can't produce, you know, actual results. Again, you read something that said, if this is implemented. Well, it was implemented. So therefore, you know, step up, give us the data that caused you, you know, confirmed your concerns, or if there's no data to confirm your concerns, then I think those concerns may be unfounded.
Ms. Rotel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Quam. I mean, because this system is, you know, confidential, we can't ask the federal government to give us those numbers of how many people have produced false negatives. That's why, you know, the Social Security Administration has done that. However, we have members that have shared with us multiple stories about, you know, legal workers that have worked for them for multiple years, that their number gets put into the system, and once the false negative comes back, they are mandated to fire that worker. There is no, you know, good appeal process at this point, and there is nothing in place. So, I mean, if you want us to produce a report of our members that are getting this, it could also put them in, you know, you're also kind of giving a lawsuit to someone to say, these are the employers that you should sue that have, you know, employed people that don't make it through the E-Verify system, even though we know the system is inaccurate.
Senator Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, nameless numbers are fine. You know, total number and then, you know, confirmed activity, something to go by other than, you know, ambiguous reports and anecdotal information. Thank you.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, I understand that there was a general GAO, General Accounting Office report on E-Verify that said there were 20% of legal employees were then found to be illegal under the system. So 20% is a huge number. And so there, that in itself, I think, defines some of the parameters of the accuracy concern. But, you know, and I think if a number of people have mentioned that this is a federal issue, and it absolutely. We have, time and time again, Congress has punted on immigration reform. And I think on a bipartisan basis, there are people in Washington that want to see, you know, immigration reform, that part of which would include a pathway to citizenship to the 12 million immigrants that are working in the United States, living here, paying taxes, and working. And until we have that that piece included in federal immigration reform, we're just, you know, nibbling around the edges with things like this. And I think even the bill as amended, I would still oppose, because we have to send a message to Washington, to Congress, to the federal government, both parties, that we really need to get moving at the federal level on this immigration issue. Otherwise, we're going to, you know, have these things like the asking the Minneapolis and St. Paul police to act as immigration officers. I mean, what? That's nonsense. I mean, and so we get these bills from time to time, and it's a federal issue, and we've got to address it that way. So that's my concern.
Ms. Rotel, and I would like to draw everyone's attention to the clock. We're about out of time here, but if you could make a brief comment.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hornstein, we'd urge you to support this amendment, mainly for hopefully sooner rather than later the federal government does act and stops punting. And if they, you know, do something this summer, we don't want to have to come back again and argue the same thing. This would make, you know, Minnesota's state contractors do this as soon as that federal law was implemented, and I think that's the direction that that Minnesota has to go in with immigration policies.
Okay. Any other questions or comments on the Green Amendment? Okay, does anybody need to restate the Green Amendment, oral amendment? Okay, seeing no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Oral amendment does prevail. Back to the bill as amended. Do we have any additional questions to the amended bill? Representative Quam, did you have an additional question? Okay.
Madam Chair, I would reserve my motion that House File 1376 pass and be referred to State Government Finance.
Representative O'Driscoll renews his motion. All those in favor, please signify. Oh, as amended. Yep.
As amended.
Okay. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
The motion does prevail.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Every.
Meeting adjourned.